Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A state representative says newly released documents are raising some serious red flags in her mind about the state's Education Achievement Authority. On today's show, we talk with Representative Ellen Cogan Lipton about what she found out about the EAA. And Detroit Mayor Dave Bing still has not settled those questions about whether or not he's going to run for another term of office. We'll get details later in the hour. But first, it is Thursday, so that means it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. This week, he has the Blue Oval in his sights, the Ford Blue Oval, following Ford's report of record pre-tax profits of $2.4 billion in North America. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So break it down for us. What do you think's behind these very, very strong North American numbers, record-setting?
Well, I think what's really behind it is a product portfolio that is clicking on all cylinders, pun definitely intended. It's taken Al Mulally about 6 years to get Ford in North America really humming, and I think this is the proof of it. It's nothing but a good news story, and I think the thing that now they're moving into is a period of growth. And it's interesting, I listened to their call yesterday, and they kept talking, particularly the chief financial officer, about growth opportunities, and where were those? Well, the first thing you would expect is that they were in Asia. They're building 5 plants in China and 2 in India, because Ford is playing catch-up with General Motors, certainly in China, and also Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. But the other place where they're looking for real growth and expect growth is in the United States. And that clearly has not been the story of the Detroit car companies for going on 30 years. The foreign automakers, particularly the Japanese, but now more recently the Koreans, have been picking up a lot of market share and have been very successful in the Smile region of the United States, i.e. the coasts and the south.
Okay.
One of the things they said yesterday is they're very excited about the fact that their Fusion midsize and their Escape compact SUV are both doing very well in those regions of the country. And that's very critical for a company like Ford to do well in the South and on the coast outside of kind of fortress Midwest.
How do you assess Ford's North America performance in relation to the competition, GM and Chrysler, who are also seeing improved results?
They are. I would say Chrysler continues to outperform in the U.S. market and has surprised a lot of people and keeps surprising them, because I think the conventional wisdom was that they didn't have the product. When in fact, I think not only do they have the product in some key areas, but they have a real art for repackaging existing product with special editions and things like that to really captivate and energize the buying public. General Motors also doing well. Chevrolet is, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's 7 or 8 consecutive record months globally in terms of sales. Cadillac is reloading with the ATS and a new CTS and the XTS that they've launched. So there's a lot of product. I think the GM story is a little different. They're going to go from having the oldest product line in product portfolio in North America to having the newest within about a year or so.
Well, we'll get back to Ford now. Certainly, as you pointed, a bright spot for Ford is Asia. Their results were good. They got market share that they're playing catch up, but it jumped from 2.6 to 3.6 in the past year. But that's still pretty low. What does Ford need to be at to be a real player in Asia, do you think?
Well, it need to be considerably higher than that. I think the issue, the real issue for these companies is this balance between market share and profitability. Right now, Asia is not a major contributor to the profitability of Ford. And I think one of the real cautions that I would raise is that, you know, we've seen this movie a little bit before. Mm-hmm. In the late 90s, early 2000s, Ford was making at or near record profits, almost all of which were coming out of the United States, specifically on 4 products that came out of 2 plants. I mean, that was really the whole shooting match. Mm. The F-Series truck with the large Expedition and Navigators, and the smaller pickup, specifically the Explorer. That's what they were making all their money on. And in other parts of the world, including Europe, where I was at the time, they really weren't. And Asia, they were just not a player. So I think now the real challenge for them is to get the other parts of the world moving kind of in lockstep forward. And one of the things that they're trying to do under Mulally and Chief Operating Officer Mark Fields is to really get the other parts of the world kind of singing from the same hymn sheet that they are here in Dearborn and in the United States. And they're starting to make progress there. I think the moves in Asia will be critical. And the expectation is by within a couple of years, it's going to be a material contributor to the profitability of the corporation.
Okay. Now, speaking from not singing from the same hymn book, let's talk a little about South America, not so smiley and shiny there with Ford losing, what, $218 million in the region before taxes. Mm-hmm. What's going on in South America?
Well, there's a couple things, I think. One is they've got their product line is aged a little bit, and they need to, or they're planning to update it. I think they're going to be launching the new Focus and Fiesta if they haven't already there. The other real challenge for them, the first quarter is not necessarily good. That's when they have Carnival down in Brazil. Mm. Typically, the first quarter in South America is the lightest quarter. But I think what's alarming is that the market expanded and their market share contracted, which suggests that the products are not catching the attention of buyers.
All right, let's take a deep breath and talk about Europe, which basically nothing to celebrate there, not just for Ford, but any and all automakers, maybe the exception of the luxury brand. So what, Ford lost $2 billion in that?
No, it's on track to lose $2 billion. It hasn't lost that much yet. That number is considerably smaller than that. I'd have to check the exact number, but it's on track to lose $2 billion, up from, I think it was about half that last year. Europe is a disaster. It's a disaster for everyone. Anybody who's particularly a volume car company. So you've General Motors, Opel. General Motors has lost something on the number of $15 billion over the last dozen years in Europe. Chrysler, Fiat has got some serious, serious issues in Italy.
Yes.
Peugeot is in trouble. Renault is struggling. And the only one that seems to be in fairly decent shape is Volkswagen, and that's largely because it's so heavily focused in Germany, and it's got a solid balance sheet and, frankly, very patient investors. So Europe will continue to be difficult. I think Ford has made more progress more quickly in Europe with trying to get their arms around their problems, certainly than General Motors has, which has been, you know, this has been a long saga that I've been writing about since the late 90s. And frankly, it hasn't materially improved over that entire period of time.
And I know that there's plant closings, but you've got the unions and redundancy packages, so that is not a quick fix. So I'm wondering, how much do you think Ford will lose before and if things turn around in Europe? Can North America keep carrying the company until Europe rebounds?
Well, they have to. I don't think they have a choice. But what I think you will see in Ford is they will continue to be aggressive. One of the things about Al Mulally and his way of looking at problems is that he doesn't kick them the can down the road. He's very aggressive at trying to match his capacity with his demand. Demand is definitely sliding. That's why they moved to close the Genk plant in Belgium, which was a major problem. Major issue and major confrontation to the point where they weren't even able to produce any vehicles. Now they're producing vehicles again until they wind that plant down. But I think you'll see them continue to move and be aggressive in trying to match their production capacity and the whole totality of the European business to what the European market is as we speak. And I think that's clearly what General Motors is trying to do as well. But I think Ford in this context is a little more adept at moving the leadership to do what it needs to do.
Let's circle back to that good news from North America with these record pre-tax profits. So it just makes you want to ask the question, why didn't Ford stock get a boost? Why is it still flat?
I think because there's a lot of worries about the other parts of the world. There are also concerns that the U.S. economy is, we're not really sure how some of the tax changes and fears of Obamacare coming in 2014, what that's going to do to the business environment and, frankly, employment. What's helping the car companies, I think, is there's a lot of pent-up demand. The average age of the car fleet in the United States is pushing 11 years, which is the oldest in anybody's memory. So I think there's a lot of folks out there that are primed and ready to replace a vehicle depending on their own financial circumstances. But there are a lot of concerns that the economy is not really gearing forward in a way and gearing up in a way that they would expect. Europe will continue to be a major drag on the stocks of General Motors and Ford for some time to come. Now, the question is, how long is that? That said, I think you could make the argument that a couple of these companies are undervalued in terms of the market, but that necessarily isn't something big-time investors are buying.
So overall, Dan House, how would you grade Ford's health, especially considering, as you point out in your piece today in the Detroit News, Ford did not take any government bailout bucks.
I think I'd give it an A-minus at a minimum to an A. You know, it's got a positive cash balance of somewhere north of $8 billion. Its total liquidity is about $35 billion. It's retired an awful lot of debt. I think the number I quote in the column today is something like $19 billion. It's generating enormous amounts of cash. It's a very much a good story, and the cash generation is coming out of the United States. So we haven't always been able to say that, and I think it's being generated the right way in terms of the across the product lines, not just on one or two products, but they're able to build smaller cars in the United States and make money on them, and that is a very good story, and it's a testament to a business model that actually makes business sense.
Detroit News business columnist Dan Howes with his look at what he calls Alan Mulally's big blue oval machine. Good talking with you. Always enjoy our Thursday talks, Dan.
Thanks very much for having me.
The Lansing School District and its teachers recently ratified a new contract that overhauls the way art and music will be taught in its schools. Art, music, and phys ed teachers will be replaced in Lansing elementary schools, and instead, contract consultants would teach those subjects alongside the regular classroom teachers. Well, that story got us wondering about the future of arts education in Michigan. Just how can school districts coping with cuts in funding and eroding tax bases and population manage to still provide arts education? And you have to ask, how much does arts education really matter in these days of heavy emphasis on the STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and math? Well, joining me now is Kathy White. She is the president and the CEO of the Michigan Assessment Consortium, and she's the project director of the Michigan Arts Education Instruction and Assessment Program. Kathy, what was your reaction to what's happened with the changes in the Lansing District, particularly what it says about arts education and what it means to districts around the state?
You know, I think Lansing is endemic of very, very difficult financial circumstances for districts, especially our large urban districts. And I also think that the kind of action that we saw recently follows cuts that we've seen across the nation, where when we have these accountability systems that put emphasis on reading and mathematics, districts feel as though they must perform in terms of standardized test scores in those areas, and sometimes they do that at the expense of their other content areas. You know, I think that where we should maybe, you know, train our sights and, you know, hope that things will improve in the future is by way of paying attention to the very positive research that speaks to the arts as being really the leading subject area in a public education that helps students meet the 21st century skills that we are valuing.
I'm curious about that because we've heard from employers who say we need these STEM workers to come in and fill the engineering and technology and science jobs. And we have educators who say we have to decide where to put our precious money and resources, and we need to do that into those STEM classes that'll make the kids more employable. So how is it? Explain how the arts will make them that employable.
Well, you know, there was an interesting survey that was done in 2010 with, we're in a 1,500 CEOs surveyed by IBM, ranked creativity as the most important leadership quality that they're looking for in their workers. And, you know, I guess I would submit that the arts purposefully teaches artistic processes of create, perform, and respond, which contribute to straight-up teaching creativity. So I think there really is, I mean, that's sort of your one-to-one match. I think that, you know, I don't mean to suggest that arts is more important than science, technology, engineering, or math. I just think that there's room for all of these subjects in a public education. So this concept that we must fight it out, you know, and one subject area will be excluded at the expense of others, I don't think that that's logical. And I'm happy to see the discussion nationally changing from STEM to STEAM, which, you know, I think is very much from the science and math part of the world, a desire to include you know, the curriculum instruction pedagogy that is a part of art into more with the science and mathematics.
So for those of us that have not heard that acronym STEAM, is that science, technology, engineering, arts, and math?
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the happy news is that you see the science and math world and the STEM world being the voice of wanting to embrace arts.
What is next for the assessment program as you're developing this education, instruction, and assessment program? Where will you go with this?
This year we've got those three deliverables that we're obligated to, actually articulating the blueprint, which is the gold standard, creating an audit tool that districts could use in terms of self-study. You know, where do they rate and what could they do in terms of program improvement? And then we have to make this assessment specifications document with prototypes that really talks about what would these assessments look like and do we have agreement that we like what the testing program would look like. When that's done, the next 2 years would be actually creating the assessments, and then as early as next year, we would hope to have some districts that would volunteer to use that blueprint and audit tool so that we could be studying them and their process to understand how they're using it and making the most and getting benefit from those two pieces.
So developing assessment tools to put into the hands of school districts all around Michigan. Kathy White, the president and CEO of the Michigan Assessment Consortium, and she's the project director of the Michigan Arts Education Instruction and Assessment Program. Kathy, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
You bet. Thank you.
Whenever there's a conversation about rebuilding Michigan, about looking for ways to generate ideas, business buzz, and jobs, more and more that conversation includes or even centers on Grand Rapids. As you heard on Stateside yesterday, Grand Rapids was number 4 on a Forbes magazine list of best cities in America to find a job. And it was April 2012 when Art Prize founder Rick DeVos launched his new effort to build entrepreneurs in West Michigan, an idea incubator, really. It was called Start Garden. Rick DeVos unveiled plans a year ago for a new $15 million seed accelerator fund, and he hoped that would help launch more than 100 new businesses, at least business ideas, every year. So let's get a first anniversary progress report on Start Garden. Joining us from Grand Rapids is Start Garden founder Rick DeVos. Welcome back to Stateside, Rick.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
So just to get everybody on the same page, I would like to have you, as the person who came up with this, kind of recap for us how Start Garden works. So I was talking to Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris, and she was saying she has a friend, Rebecca, and Rebecca actually has been trying to develop a business idea called Rent an Extrovert. So that extrovert would do all the things for a shy retiring person that person would have a tough time doing. It's a pretty good, she's really working
maybe,
on this.
Maybe I should be a customer for that.
So let's just say Rebecca has this idea. She comes to Start Garden with Rent an Extrovert with her pitch. Then what?
How it works is every week we have online submissions. It's all through startgarden.com. So people upload a description of their idea, answer some brief questions about themselves and their idea. And then every week we make two $5,000 investments. One of those is based on a public endorsement process. So whoever can get the most people to vote for them through our site. And then the other is based on the Start Garden team sitting around. We have a weekly meeting where we review everything that's been submitted that week and select one. And out of those $5,000 investments, they are required to come to an update night 60 to 90 days after receiving that investment, where they basically account for what they've done with that investment. And then from that update night, we actually have another one coming up this evening.
Mm-hmm.
We make decisions about who we're going to invest in further. We actually go into it with decisions already made about who we're going to invest in, but generally we're investing about $20,000 in the next round.
Wow.
It's really interesting what you learn from giving people resources and watching what they do with them rather than spending a lot of time doing due diligence. When you're launching new things, it's really difficult to impossible to do due diligence.
Yes.
We find it much more useful to find out who the person is, what their experience is, what their vision is, and then see how they work.
So what do these entrepreneurs do, have you in this past year that you've seen? What have they done with that initial $5,000?
You know, it's everything. It really depends on what their idea is. And we focus on and really push them to do an experiment with that $5,000 investment. So if you're selling a product and that's your first offering for, let's say it's a children's toy company, you might use it to run a marketing campaign and see what sort of conversion rates you can get and how many orders you can take. That really carries a lot of weight for us when we're thinking about who to invest in further. The best sort of validation is paying customers. So anything to validate or de-risk, you know, some part of the hypothesis that you're, you know, basically proposed by starting this business. You are ideally solving a problem with a business. Is it really a problem?
Okay. So taking what's a hypothesis and beginning the process of proving that it could be reality.
Yep, absolutely.
So give me an idea of some of the investments in the companies that really, really grabbed you, that really made you go, wow, that are starting to take root and grow.
You know, I stress that we're still in the very earliest stages of these things, so it's going to take years for a lot of these things to really prove out. We started off with a company called Next Mile that makes youth sports-specific insoles. They continue to do a good job selling product and expanding their offering line. Kind of the fun example that I usually talk about is a little startup that we invested in called Reindeer Cam. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a camera that streams reindeer in a pen. And during the Christmas season, Santa comes out and feeds the reindeer three times a day.
Okay, that's pretty awesome.
They have hundreds of thousands of unique visitors, millions of people streaming it. They sold over 40,000 $2 downloads of their app. They actually used our investment to develop that app. So there's a bunch of fun ways they can take it from here. And it shows kind of what something that seems quite silly when it came in, you know, and that was one that was actually selected by the public vote, and we were very skeptical at the beginning and very worried that people were going to, you know, just laugh at us essentially for investing in Reindeer Cam. But
clearly, the public knew.
yeah. Well, they already had actually a pretty thriving community built around this thing. So it, you know, just goes to show that when you're starting new things, you need to just kind of launch the ships and see if there are continents out there. You can't plan your way to it.
I know I was reading. There's been a lot of attention from, you know, national publications, New York Times. I was reading a lot of interviews that you gave about Start Garden, and one of the things I was struck with was you were talking about, apart from putting cash into the hands of entrepreneurs, you really wanted to get a buzz happening about West Michigan and about the business climate and hoping to encourage people to follow their dream. And it strikes me, when you're working in the public voting, that's exactly what you did with Art Prize. So suddenly the whole community's invested.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we learned that obviously the public vote gets people engaged. It brings things through the filter that you wouldn't necessarily see value in at the beginning, which we think is interesting at Star Garden. But it's a constant marketing message. Everybody that is putting ideas up on Star Garden, telling their networks about them, they're telling people about their projects, and we're seeing whether they can get some validation from that. But they're also carrying the germ of the idea of Star Garden to everybody as well. So we continue to get the word out about Star Garden. And we, you know, we want to create a change in culture around startups and people trying things.
Rick DeVos, where have you been getting ideas from? Are you getting them from all over the country?
We see some from other states and regions. The majority are, you know, within probably a 3-hour drive of Grand Rapids. So, you know, Michigan in general. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we'll see a couple things from Chicago and so forth and Indiana. But, we're always looking at how a company that we would invest in would gain benefit from the ecosystem here, the startup ecosystem here, and how it would contribute to the startup ecosystem here. So that's sort of how we're evaluating whether to invest that $5,000 amount in them, but especially with the later investments.
We've been talking with Start Garden founder Rick DeVos, getting that first year anniversary report on his project to help entrepreneurs and build entrepreneurs in West Michigan. Always good to talk with you. We look forward to doing it again. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the major issues when it comes to education in Michigan is the EAA, the Education Achievement Authority, the new school system for Michigan's lowest performing public schools. Since last fall, 15 Detroit schools have been run under the EAA, and now there's movement in Lansing to expand the EAA and start including more underperforming schools into the authority. The State House has already passed legislation to do exactly that, despite the objections of Democrats who argue the move is premature. They want proof positive that the Education Achievement Authority really works before moving ahead to expand it. State Democratic Representative Ellen Cogan Lipton of Huntington Woods is looking for that proof. She's called for data to support claims that the EAA is indeed working. Late last month, Representative Lipton filed a Freedom of Information Act request, trying to get answers to her questions about just how successful the EAA has been so far. This week, she got some information, but not all that she had requested. Representative Lipton joins us now from Lansing. Welcome to Stateside, Representative.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So start off by telling us, what was it you were requesting in the FOIA? What were you trying to find out exactly?
Well, a number of areas. We, and really based on questions that were not answered during the very brief committee hearings. We asked for information regarding special education students. There was some disparity in numbers that were not really accounted for. We wanted information on teacher turnover. We were hearing from parents and students that many of the teachers were leaving, and students were having 3, 4, and 5 different teachers for the same class. We wanted information about the sources and dollar amount of some of the private foundation dollars that we had heard had provided additional startup funding for the EAA. We wanted information regarding qualifications and certifications of the teachers that were teaching in the EAA. And in large part, information that could have been provided during the public committee hearings, but simply were not.
So you didn't hear that, and you wanted to get the information, so you filed the Freedom of Information Act request, and then what happened?
Well, the initial response back that I got was that they would start assembling the documents, that they would provide them to me. The hope was that, although we didn't get these questions answered for us in the House, the hope was that I would be able to provide a lot of this information to the Senate, because that's where the bill is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they denied the request and said that if I made what they call a good faith deposit, that they would begin assembling the documents. So I immediately did that. Then I got another response back saying that here's some of the documents, about 100 pages of documents, that there will be more documents forthcoming, but because of the voluminous nature of the request, I would have to pay, I think the amount was something like $2,500, $2,600, which I immediately did, and I notified them that I was going to be doing that, so that they better start, you know, preparing the documents. They did ask for an extension. I'm hoping that the remaining documents I will have in hand by tomorrow. That's the due date.
That's the due date.
Yeah, and as they come in, I have been scanning them and putting them up on my website, because what I'm hearing is that a lot of organizations, news organizations, education advocacy groups have made FOIA requests and have been blocked by being charged very, very high fees. And it's had a huge chilling effect in the ability of people to get documents.
And as you say, that deadline should be tomorrow, so we'll have to see whether you get that. Now, you are a former teacher, and I think that's worth reemphasizing so we understand where you're coming from. And you actually spoke, am I correct, with students from Mumford High School?
I am, just to be clear, I'm a patent attorney by training.
Mm-hmm.
I am a biochemist and have taught chemistry to students. And one of the things that they kept reiterating in committee as the reason behind the need for this expansion of EAA is that, well, by golly, we have to do something. And we have to do something for these kids. And so my question was, well, what do the kids say? You know, what do the kids think? During the time of the hearing, I got an extremely heartfelt email from a group of students at Mumford. And they wrote just a beautiful email and introduced themselves to me and said, please, we invite you and any other of your colleagues to come and talk to us. And I shared that with everyone on the committee. Me and one other of my colleagues went down to Mumford and spent about half a day with the students, listening to them and hearing their concerns. And I have to say, it was just, I got an earful.
It was just two of you that came and followed up on that invitation?
Yes, at that time.
Okay. So
yep.
Tell me what the kids told you. What did you see when you were there talking? What did you hear?
Well, I asked them many of the same questions that the supporters of the bill used as a sort of evidence of the need for expansion. So one of the things I said was, one of the things that we're hearing is that the schools are safer now, and the kids just started like laughing, you know. Like, are you kidding me? And I said, no, that's what they're saying. They said, absolutely not. And then they started telling me stories of instances where they feel less safe, where they feel more threatened. I said, okay, well, one of the things that the proponents are saying is that there's this student-centered learning environment, that every student gets to learn at their own pace.
Mm-hmm.
This customized software package called Buzz. They said Buzz is a joke. They said it is demeaning. It is not challenging. We hate to use it. One little boy looked up at me and said, "Oh, one of the questions I asked was, you know, do you like your school now? Do you like it better now, or did you like it better before?" And they said, we liked it better before. And I said, why? Tell me why. And one little boy, he said, look around this room. He said, do you see any books? And by golly, not a single book in the classroom. And he said, you know what? I really miss my books. He said, we have no books anymore. Kids said, we miss class discussions. Several of the students said, we come to class, we don't know who our teacher is going to be on any given day. Different teachers, you know, keep showing up. We don't have any continuity. It was heartbreaking.
What are they using in lieu of books?
Basically, when you hear the term student-centered learning, that's sort of the
buzz term, yep.
The buzzword that's thrown around. And the way it plays out in the EAA is each student is given a notebook computer.
All right.
And they walk the computer from class to class, okay? And at each class, they log in. So the module that one of the students walked me through, he was a 10th grade English student, and signed into Buzz. There's a menu of options, and he clicked on English 10. So the module pops up like a course syllabus of what you have to go through. So the one that he was on was Of Mice and Men.
All right.
And I turned to him, I said, oh, that's a great book. I said, you know, I'd really like to read the book. And I said, well, you know, you'll get to. I mean, that, you know, how do you teach Of Mice and Men without reading the book? And he said, well, let me show you. And he started clicking through the plan, and by golly, not a single opportunity to be linked to the actual text. Instead, it was a series of almost like cartoons and pre-taped lectures of someone sort of a face on the screen pops up telling the students about Of Mice and Men.
So doing basically a recap.
doing a recap, and I said to him, well, you know, I said, surely, you know, come on, there's going to be a place where you actually get to click and read the book. And he said, well, no, actually, I can tell you that is not the case. And I said, well, okay, that's not great, but at least you can go to your school library and check out the book. And that's when he started laughing, and he said, you don't have a school library anymore. The books are gone.
What is the feasibility of the students who are living with this situation, the kinds of kids you spoke with? Could they not come and testify before the state Senate and tell their story to be on the record and be there, or is there some concern for the students doing that?
Well, you know, I had hoped that at least the chair in the House would at least recognize. I entered the letter that I received. I entered it into the record, but I was sort of hoping that the chair would make more of a note of it, or perhaps use some kind of Skype or something to allow the students to have their voices heard. But that was not received. It wasn't.
Well, what about from the other way, Representative? What about students and parents who are in these schools and have these concerns? Why can they not come and be part of the hearings? And instead of waiting for instead of trying to work it from the chairman, bring them to Lansing. Could that not happen?
Well, what I can tell you is that when one teacher in an EAA school, she got signed permission slips from all of the parents of the students, and she wanted them to testify at a Detroit community meeting.
All right.
Now, forget getting them to Lansing, but she just wanted to bring them to a group of concerned citizens that were convening a meeting at Mary Grove.
Yes.
And so she got signed permission slips from all of the students' parents and took them on a field trip to testify, to tell the community in their own words what was going on in their school. And when she got to school the next day, she was put on suspension.
Hmm. What are your ultimate concerns for the students in these EAA schools, or if it's expanded? What's your biggest fear for these students?
Well, my biggest fear is that, having spoken to them, they know that they are not getting a quality education. You know, I had a number of students say to me, I may be poor, but I'm not stupid. And at the very least, this is not a recipe for success. They should be able to have enriching class discussions. They should be able to have teachers that they can count on when they come to school the next day. It's going to be the same teacher that's going to be engaged. This is what they want. This is what makes for a quality education. To me, what I'm gonna keep fighting for, and it's not acceptable to say, well, you know, at least we're doing something. You know, I mean, if the something is worse than the problem that you were trying to solve, that's not a solution in my book.
So this story will be unfolding. We will follow up with you to see what kind of information you do get if you do receive it by your deadline tomorrow. I know we'll be talking again. State Democratic Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton of Huntington Woods, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Representative.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you're looking for more information about the Education Achievement Authority, the EAA, Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has spent quite a lot of time investigating the EAA for Michigan Radio. In fact, Sarah was actually escorted right out of Detroit's Mumford High School on one of her reporting trips by the principal of the school, who is no longer actually at Mumford. You can find her series of reports online at michiganradio.org. Well, we have seen sports droughts in this state, that's for sure. Lions, how about that? Last time they won the NFL championship was 1957. Well, there's been a similar drought in the world of bowling leagues, but that drought might be about to end. Mel Shannon has been bowling with the Knights of Columbus Men's League in Ann Arbor for just about as long as anybody can remember. The last time Mel won the championship was 46 years ago, 1967. But Mel is on the verge of winning the championship again tonight. Mel is a World War II veteran. He's 87 years young, and he stopped by the studio along with John Kennard, who's also part of the KFC Men's Bowling League. And I asked Mel about how he felt about the possibility that he's about to win the championship for the first time since 1967.
Feel great. Great, really. Really, I do. Really, I do. Have a wonderful team. Younger, of course, much younger than me, but they're a lot of fun.
And did I understand you used to bowl, Mel Shannon, with John Kennard's dad? Do you guys go back that far?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. John Sr., yes.
John, what does it mean for all of you in the KFC League, the Knights of Columbus League, to have Mel there and active and part of the action?
You know, Mel really, I think, encompasses a lot of the modern values, you know, diversity, and he's friendly. He's obviously not afraid of change, having been in the league for 48 years.
I've got to imagine, John, just for everyone in the league, having the continuity of having Mel a part of this, and just, you can't even put that into words what that must mean.
That's right. I mean, when you think about it, 48 years, that's about 4,800 games that Mel's bowled in the league. So a record that I would suspect won't be broken for quite a while.
Well, best of luck. We want to hear that you won the championship, Mel, and Mel's machine can celebrate and hoist another trophy.
Thank you very much.
That was bowler Mel Shannon, along with his fellow Mel's machine teammate, John Kennard, both from the Knights of Columbus Men's League in Ann Arbor. Go, Mel. And we love to hear from you. Connect with us very easily. Find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, you can search for Cynthia Canty, Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Mercedes Mejia. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, birthday girl Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and we will talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.